Chapter 13 is nicely divided into two parts. And the two parts are showing us symbolically how Satan works in the church age to attack the people of God. The focus on the first section that we're in here is on the dragon's persecution of the church. And remember, this is after he has failed, we saw in the previous chapters, failed to consume the child, failed to destroy the child, the child being Christ, lives his life, ascends into heaven. And after the ascension into heaven, Satan is cast out of heaven, where he can no longer come and accuse the saints before God, because instead of the accuser, we now have an advocate who stands before the Father. Satan comes down to earth, he's cast down to earth, and the text tells us he comes with great wrath. Woe to you who live on the earth. And we begin to see this played out and how Satan goes after the church now. If you recall, we began in 12:1 a new section in this cyclical understanding of the book of Revelation. So we're starting from the beginning of the period of history that starts with Christ's birth, and now we're in the middle of the description of this period of life in the present evil age. And at the end of chapter 14, you'll see the return of Christ that signals, again, the end of the age. And so this section focuses primarily to describe the period from Christ's birth to his return in the focus of seeing how Satan attacks the church. How does Satan persecute the church? And that's what the focus is on. It's really on what can we expect in the present evil age. The symbolism here of chapter 13 shows us that attack. It shows us what Satan's doing. The first beast, which we just read about, described in verses 1 through 10, shows Satan's persecuting power as it is operative in and through the systems of the government and the rulers and the nations of the world. And this takes place throughout the centuries. The persecution of the church that is commanded by national entities, by rulers and dictators and conquerors and so forth and so on. You'll notice here, and it's an important thing to notice, in verse 11 through 18, this describes a different beast. And the description of that beast is showing Satan's attack through the godless and false religions and godless philosophies that are used in the world in the present age to lead us astray, not through persecution, but through wrong teaching that really infiltrate the church and bring harm to it. In chapter 14, in verse 8, you actually have a third entity that is described. And this is, we just see an introduction, and later in the book we'll find out more about it, but it's this city Babylon. And Babylon is also an agent that is used by Satan for a different purpose, and that is to seduce Christians away from following Christ by giving us the things of the world. You almost see an idea of the parable of the seeds played out here. The idea that when trials and tribulations come, Christians will pull away and they'll leave the faith, even though they started with joy. You see false teaching come in, and that's Satan grabbing a hold of the seed before it has time to get into the ground and germinate. And then you see the riches and pleasures of the world symbolized in Babylon that seduce Christians away or professing people away. And what we're going to do tonight is look at the first one, the first method of Satan's attack, his anti-Christian persecution through the forms of government. As Hendrickson notes in this section, he says, all three of these agents are employed by Satan in his attack against the earth. They are the anti-Christian persecution, the anti-Christian religion, and the anti-Christian seduction. And so, as you think about the passage, you can kind of see the beast as representative of what we would call the Antichrist. The Antichrist may or may not be a person. We'll wrestle with that later in the book of Revelation. But we certainly see here in these passages that there are systems in the world that are anti-Christian that Satan is using to draw people away from Christ, and that he uses them to attack the church and to cause us to suffer in this life. Now, what we're finding here is that because Satan employs the government, because Satan employs authorities in the world to persecute the church, we should not be surprised when these things happen to us. This is what Peter reminds us. Don't be surprised at the fiery trials that come among you. Don't act like these things are strange. Some strange thing isn't happening to you. Rather, this is what's been happening to the church for 2,000 years. And so we have three points that I want to make. First of all, is the relationship of the dragon and the beast, which is important in understanding the symbolic nature of the passage. Secondly, we're going to look at the authority given to the beast so that we understand what's happening in the world around us. Thirdly, we'll see the worship of the beast. And the worship of the beast is really what's signaling to us when people have fallen into this antichrist governmental system that Satan employs to attack the church. Now, as I was thinking about this, the relevancy of this passage, I don't know if it could get any more relevant for the day. I didn't plan this, but what's happening now in Canada, it's incredible because just this week I was informed about a whole group of Canadian Christians who are fleeing the country. They're actually coming through Montana, which was the only reason I heard about it. And they're leaving because the pastors are being threatened to be put in jail. The Christians aren't allowed to meet in their churches. They're being shut down. And so they're seeking refugee status here in the United States so that they can worship God freely. And I think that as we consider this, it's extremely relevant to our lives, because if you've noted the history of Canada, you'll note that the United States follows along a few decades behind Canada, typically, in their progression towards liberalism and communism, which, again, for us is important because we need to be prepared for this and not surprised by it when it comes. Let's look at the text now, the relationship between the dragon and the beast. Note verse 1. We see the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. And then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns, 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. The first thing we see here is the dragon, who we've noted in the previous chapter, and that this is Satan, the serpent of old, that he's standing on the sand of the seashore, which is kind of a strange way to put it. But remember, this is a symbolic vision, and it's pointing us to something. The imagery here is pointing us to the dragon's sway over the world. And you'll find throughout the scriptures this idea of the sands of the seashore representing great multitudes of people. In fact, in chapter 20, in verse 8, it says, he will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. And so the idea here is Satan's great influence over the world, over multitudes of people, over many nations, and his authority over those multitudes is what's being exemplified here, in that he stands on the sands of the seashore. Hendrickson says, we interpret the picture as follows. The sea represents nations and their governments, where the roaring of peoples is compared to the roaring of the sea, and the surging of nations to the surging of mighty waters. Now, notice what happens. As the dragon is standing on the sands of the seashore, suddenly, John says here, then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. And if we represent the sea as people, as the peoples and the nations and the sand of the seashore is constituting the multitudes, we begin to understand what's happening. With Satan's sway over the nations, out from the multitudes, out from the nations, rises a beast that is of Satan's design. And what he represents is Satan's persecution of the church in and through the governments of the nations. That's what the first beast is all about. Now notice the description of the beast, and this continues to emphasize who he is or what he is. It says he's having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. Now, what this is representing is the leaders and nations who are invested with satanic powers to rule and are employed by Satan for the purpose of persecuting the church. You notice here that the beast has crowns on his horns. Horns represent military might when we're talking about prophetic literature or apocalyptic literature. Horns, if you look at Daniel and all the talk about horns there, it's always about military might. And so the dragon of chapter 12, we notice, had crowns on his head. The beast has crowns on his horns. And this is suggesting that while the dragon is the ultimate ruler over the worldly empire, while Satan's ruling over all three of these entities that we're going to see, the military might of his empire rests in these nations and these rulers who constitute this conglomerate that we call the beast. The beast isn't one person. It's not one nation. It's not one anything. It's representative of all of the nation's power and military might that has been enforced throughout the age to persecute the church. Now, that's very important to note. This is the kingdom of the world as it regards its military might. That's what the beast is representing. Notice what's written on his heads. Blasphemous names. Blasphemous names written on his head. And you might think of blasphemous names as using the Lord's name as a curse word, but it's worse than that. The blasphemous names are names like Lord, names like Savior, names like God, Provider, the one who cares for you. This is what's written on the head. The names that belong to the one and true God alone are ascribed to this beast that comes up out of the sea. And what's being represented here is that the systems of government found in the beast are attempting to take the place of God by bringing hope, bringing refuge, bringing salvation, we might say, to the people of the world. They are looking to the government and the military might of the government as their source of trust. Now, we all know we shouldn't put our trust in the might of men. We shouldn't put our trust in many horses or spearmen or bowmen or military might at all, but we put our trust in God. This is a lesson that Israel had to learn over and over and over again throughout their history. As God would decimate, as he decimated Egypt, without Israel ever lifting a finger to war against their oppressors. The military government here, represented in the beast, comes in and says, listen, we'll be your savior. We'll be your protector. We'll keep you safe. You don't have to trust in God. You don't have to look out for anything else. Just trust in us. We'll take care of you. Note verse 2. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him power and his throne and great authority. Now, this is all kind of pushing us back to the imagery found in the book of Daniel. But also, I think just to make it simple, the description is meant to invoke the idea of military might and power. It's meant to give you the idea of an impressive war machine that is virtually undefeatable. It's a beast coming out of the sea. And the beast is like a leopard, and his feet like those of a bear, and the mouth of a lion. Terrifying to behold, something that if you had to go up against yourself, you would quail in fear and run and have no chance of defeating. And that's the idea here. Now, I want you to note something without going too far into this. Look at verse 11 in chapter 13. Look at the description of the second beast. "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon." You see the contrast here, and it's an important one to note. One, the first beast is aggressively powerful. He's displaying his strength and his military might so as to invoke fear in the people who see him. The second one comes in as a lamb. And when it says he speaks like a dragon, this is taking you back to ancient literature, that he speaks seductive words. He poses as a lamb, a gentle, nice, kind lamb. And so what you begin to see here is how one works on the power of military might, and the other one works for this subtle display of peaceful and kind of kind thinking, like the worldly wisdom. Let's all get along and be kind, and let's do things right, and we'll establish our own religion. And this is the dragon speaking. This is the dragon speaking in the ear of Eve. "Oh, you know what? It's not going to be that bad if you eat that fruit. Come on over here and I'll make you wise like God." And so you see what we're up against, and we'll get into more of that next week. But I want you to note that contrast for now. What we see now is the power of deception plus the power of fear. And deception, when coupled with fear, is powerful indeed. It can lay low nations. And we've seen this throughout the history of the world. We see also there in verse 2, "The dragon gave him power and his throne and great authority." The rulers of this world are granted a measure of power and authority that comes from Satan. Now you remember, when Jesus goes into the wilderness after his baptism, remember what Satan tries to tempt him with. "Bow down and worship me, and I'll give you all the nations of the world, because they're mine, and I have the freedom to give them. You can be the king of it all. You can skip the cross and the pain and the suffering, and I'll just hand it all over to you if you'll just worship me." And so when Jesus refuses, when Jesus fulfills the failed covenant of works in that wilderness, and Satan knows he's defeated at the resurrection, and we find here his attack against the world, he goes out with a measure of that same authority over the nations, and he gives them power. He gives them power to rule, and he uses that ruling power to persecute the church. They blaspheme God, they blaspheme Christ, and they make up one part of what we call an antichrist system, the system and the kingdom that is this world. Now, this antichrist system is the employment of governments, false religions, and the seduction of worldly powers to deceive, to persecute, and to disrupt the church in our unity in the faith. Now, as we move through this section in the coming weeks, I want you to really grab hold of how powerful our enemy is in one sense. That the whole world lies in the lap of the evil one for the purpose of drawing us away, disrupting the church, and persecuting the church. Notice verse 3. "I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast." What we'll find over and over again with Satan's ploys is that he attempts to mimic Christ. He attempts to do the things that Christ did. And here, the beast is mimicking Christ and mimicking him in the sense of his resurrection. Governments always end up seeking their citizenry to treat the government as divine. Every government has always gone this route. And one of these heads we see here has a fatal wound, as if it had been slain. Now you notice the language there is trying to mimic Jesus, who we saw back in chapter 5, verse 6, standing before the throne of God, a lamb as if slain. The same idea here. In some way, this beast impresses the world, and he does so by resurrecting some old form of government, some form of might, some form of power that was long thought to be dead. And this impresses the people. And the world sees this, and they're amazed by it, and it causes them to worship the beast. Phillips says, one of the most significant features of the beast in Revelation 13 is the way he parodies the death and resurrection of Jesus. He says in Revelation, and notice this, Christ wears many diadems, so the beast has as many crowns. Christ has a worthy name written on him, so the beast bears blasphemous names. Christ has people from every tribe and language and people and nation, so the beast assumes power over every tribe and people and language and nation. Christ is worshipped together with God, so the beast demands false worship with Satan. Now, this isn't any kind of conspiracy theory or anything like that, but what he's describing to us are the governments of the world. And if you know enough about history, you'll recognize and see this theme throughout history, that eventually, at some point, the governments of the world, especially the mighty ones, begin to demand worship from their people, unquestioning devotion. That's why the American experiment with liberty was such just an absolutely strange thing. The Puritans recognized the problem, and they did everything they could in the forming of the Constitution to get rid of this power in our country. Now, we may have gotten rid of this power to some degree, but remember, there's still two other entities, and we have no way to get rid of those. And in fact, we could argue maybe we're better off being persecuted rather than being seduced by Babylon. Let's keep going here in verse 4. They worship the beast because he gave his authority to, they worship the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him? Now you notice what happens here. They worship the dragon because he gave the authority to the beast. Tyrannical, powerful, wicked rulers have that one thing in common. They promoted false religions. They promoted state worship. Now, especially in John's day, this is referencing the Empire of Rome, where you would have to go and burn incense and say, Caesar is Lord. And when a Caesar died, he was considered divine at that point. And the main religion of Rome at this time was emperor worship. It was the worship of Rome. You were required to bow down and kiss the eagle and do all of those things. What they're doing is working through the systems that Satan has created in order to distort our Christian faith, to move us away from it. And when we fail to worship the beast in his image, we become persecuted people. One writer said this: dictators create their own personal mythology or have others do it for them. Most of all, they demand people's unquestioning and unconditional submission, something that only God has the right to do. Notice what the people cry out here. Who is like the beast? Who is able to wage war with him? You can think of this in John's day in regard to the Roman Empire. Who's like the Roman Empire in John's day? Who is able to wage war against Rome? I mean, the Parthians could come in and shoot their bows at him every once in a while and really be a pain in the neck. But it took centuries for them to finally have any effect. And so what we see is the people mimicking the worship of God. They exchange the glory of God for an image of a person. They worship and follow this false god into all sorts of atrocities. I mean, the recent one, I know it gets brought up all the time, but is is Adolf Hitler in Germany, the kind of devotion he demanded from his citizens, and the atrocities that the people committed in following after their leader, who they thought could never be defeated, who they thought was invincible, who said, "Who's going to wage war with us? We'll take over the whole world." The beast is evident whenever government takes the place of God in a society. Vern Poitras says this: "Satan wants people to look to the state as if it were the Messiah." Now, I guess the question is, how do we apply this? Well, it's actually a pretty simple application. Don't worship the state. Don't put your hope, your trust, your joy, your comfort, don't put anything in the government. The government can quickly become your God. And Christians, we do this, right? Last election cycle, it's all over. Country's lost. Everything's without hope now. Why? Well, because we're putting our trust in men. God can work through anyone he wants and through whatever means he wants. And so we don't need to fear these things, and we certainly don't need to put our trust in these things. One writer, I like this, he said, "Whenever we sing the secular doxology that goes, 'Praise the state from whom all blessings flow,' we will soon be serving the beast." When we're looking to the state for our hope, we are serving the beast. Don't invest yourself in saving governments. Recognize that even our government, as much as I love our country and our constitution, our government lies in the lap of the evil one. It would be a dangerous thing for us to invest ourselves in patriotism that takes us beyond the Christian faith. Let's notice the second point, and that's the beast's authority. Look at verse 5. "There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him." Again, you see this time period is the same time period we've been seeing throughout the book of Revelation, 42 months. It's again used to describe the period from Christ's resurrection to his return. And the point is this: he's been given authority for a limited time. This present evil age is the period of his authority. For this age, the beast has authority to act. Dennis Johnson says, "During this period, the church will be persecuted and protected, witnessing invincibly and yet trampled underfoot, conquered but not destroyed. Therefore, this beast and its persecuting power would outlast the fall of Rome in the 5th century. It continues to find various expressions, some more overt and potent than others, down to this very day." For the entire period, governments and nations will continue to speak arrogant words and blasphemies. This is just what Psalm chapter 2 is telling us. The peoples devise a vain thing. The kings and rulers of the world get together and they take their stand against God and they say, "Let us tear their fetters apart and let us cast away their cords from us. Let's get rid of this whole God idea. Let's get rid of this whole idea of morality and let's just have the people worship us and we'll run the world." And it's, again, very important for us to notice this because we live in this world. And I think often as Christians, we think that we've entered into some theocratic state here where God's running the United States of America and we're free from all of these oppressions. And it's a dangerous place for us to think. In fact, I think it's right where Satan wants us to be. Because when things begin to change, as they have begun to change in the last decade, Christians get very unsettled. We get very worried. And all that's being demonstrated is we are putting our trust in the wrong place. Let's keep going here in verses 6 through 7. "He opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle," that is, those who dwell in heaven. "It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him." So the beast has this authority to persecute the church. He has authority to wage war against the church, and notice there, to overcome them. This authority that the government has over the churches is one that's delegated by God. We've seen this in the first chapters 2 and 3, the letters to the churches that were, John warns them, some of you are going to prison, and then 10 days later you're going to die. Some of you are going to be persecuted until death. Remain faithful the whole time. We think of the two witnesses that we saw in chapter 11, how they represent the church in this age. In chapter 11, verse 7, it says, when they had finished their testimony, the beast that comes up out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them. Now, what this seems to indicate, and what I think it indicates, is a great increase in violent aggression against the church just prior to Christ's return. I think that the beast grows. He gets bigger and more powerful. That one day, prior to Christ's return, that we're going to enter a period in this age in which persecution is ramped up to a great extreme. Authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. And then you see the effect of that in verse 8. All who dwell on the earth will worship him. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. So you get an idea here of the ramping up of persecution in the world to such a degree that the church is all but wiped out. And if we're not wiped out, we're in hiding somewhere. We're no longer a visible church in the world. We're just hiding out and fleeing as refugees. And the world embraces this fully to such a degree that they begin to worship the very governments that are persecuting the church. I mean, this sounds incredible to us, but not only has this happened before, this is happening now in many countries. And not only is it happening now, we are being promised, Paul tells Timothy, in the last days, evil men will increase from bad to worse. Things are not going to get easier for us. And we need to be ready for this in our hearts and minds, having them fixed and trusting in a God who cares for us and who will cause us to persevere throughout all of these things. Everyone buys in except for the Christians, those whose names are written from the foundation of the world in the Lamb's Book of Life. You see again there at the end, you see the hope. By trusting in Jesus Christ alone, not the state, but trusting in Christ alone, we can be sure, we can be certain that we are indeed those whose names have been recorded in that book. We can have great assurance in this, that we will persevere through the greatest of persecutions, even unto death. That I don't have to sit around and worry, well, how am I going to respond to this? How am I going to respond to persecution when it comes my way? What am I going to do? Well, if you're trusting in Jesus Christ alone, then you don't have to worry. God will cause you to persevere, and not just to get through it, but he will glorify his name even through the death of his martyrs. We should be those who rejoice to be counted worthy to suffer for the name of Christ. You notice what he says here in verse 9. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. In other words, he says in verse 9, listen up, listen to what's being said here, take it in. If anyone is destined for captivity, that's where you're going. He's saying embrace it. Embrace the providence of God in your life, no matter where it takes you. Embrace it joyfully. We need to embrace suffering as part of God's plan for us to conform us to the image of Christ and to glorify the name of Christ in the world. It means that we have been counted worthy to suffer for the sake of Christ's name. Philip says the calling does not preclude us from taking prudent steps to avoid persecution, But it does mean that when persecution comes, Christians must embrace it with faith and a resolve to do God's will. This is why we're being told this. This is why the book of Revelation has been written. It's not so that you can say, oh, this stuff's going to happen, you know, way in the future during 7 years of tribulation when we'll all be gone and we don't have to worry about any of this. This is being written for us today so that we would be prepared, that we would be fixed in our minds, that we're going to continue looking to Christ no matter what comes our way. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. That's kind of a strange one. You go, what does that mean? Well, you notice that the exhortation there in verse 9 was used repeatedly in chapters 2 and 3. Remember, he ended all the letters, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And he's doing that to encourage the churches not to compromise, but to bear up, even under the great consequences that they're facing in persecution, that you're going to suffer for your faith. And so with that kind of discernment, they should be strengthened to endure their destiny of captivity in prison, even their death by the sword. We should be encouraged in this. G.K. Beale says, their spiritual insight should motivate them to suffer according to the will of God and to entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. He says, Christians are to obey the state because it was ordained by God. But when the state oversteps its bounds and demands religious worship of itself, then Christians are not to submit, but they are to submit to the punishments that the state decrees for this noncompliance. The idea then is taking us back to chapters 2 and 3. Some of you will go to prison. Some of you will be killed. Some of you will be persecuted in severe ways. But you need to persevere to the end in godliness. You need to persevere willingly enduring the persecution that comes from Satan's system. And then he ends it. Here's the perseverance and the faith of the saints. That we can endure this, that we can get through this, because God will keep us. Christ will hold us fast. You don't have to worry about, well, what if I get in the middle of being tortured for my faith and I somehow, the pain causes me to say, forget it, I recant Christ. That's never going to happen for the true Christian. If you are looking to Christ in faith now, that will not take place. God will keep us to the very end. Now, we see here the beast will wage war against us, but we also see God will cause us to stand. God will cause us to stand so that in the end we can look back and we can magnify the power of God, that he caused us to stand in the midst of great persecution, and that we would glorify the name of Christ in such a way. I mean, I think we all think about this at some point. I know I do, about what it would be like to be a martyr and to be like Polycarp, you know, who stands up there and just boldly goes to his death for the name of Christ. Now, I hope we don't have to go through that. I don't have a martyr's complex, and I don't look forward to any sort of pain at all, not even a little bit of pain. But what if it came? And the great strength is knowing God will cause you to endure so as to glorify the name of Christ in that situation. And so it causes me not to worry. I don't have to sweat this. I just have to keep looking to Christ. And that's what's needed in the church. Perseverance and faith to stand firm in the face of persecution.